Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, Anna Podjaisky, and this episode I talked to artist and researcher Jennifer Crouch about her work involving fibres. I feel like Jennifer is probably the perfect person to come on this podcast because her current expertise is sitting directly in the middle of craft and science. Because in her work at the moment, she's visualising physical sort of scientific phenomena through craft using handmaking techniques like weaving. So I first clocked Jennifer on Twitter. We've got quite a few mutual friends, sort of through the science communication circuit, but also at UCL. And we eventually met up to have this podcast conversation. And I had a very awkward moment where I fangirled Jennifer and her work. So for my own benefit, I'm starting the tape after that when I kicked things off by asking Jennifer how she came to work at the interface of physics and crafting.
So my artistic background is a bit odd. I started off doing physics at university, which was really nice. Physics is really interesting, and there's all these really nice, the secret behaviour of materials or of matter is really, really nice to learn about. But I was actually really bad at it. Really, really, really bad at it. And bad at maths. And I just was really interested in it. So I decided that it wasn't the thing for me. But I had done a geology unit, which I found really interesting, and had done quite a lot of writing about or reading and studying about sand dunes, which was good. And about fossils. It's a weird combination, but it was in the University of Aberdeen, and the University of Aberdeen really like oil. So they're just like, hey, let's get everyone to do geophysics or geology, even though they're doing different subjects. So that there was somebody on the geology unit who was doing a degree in Spanish. So it's a bit of a weird mix. But my drawings of fossils were good. So I figured out that I could draw. And it was a 4-year degree, but I dropped out after my third year. I just was like, this is not the right place for me. And then started an illustration undergraduate at Camberwell, which was really good. So I was quite interested in the idea of a sign representing a process, like how you'd get in an equation, but also about non-verbal symbolic languages and how an image can represent a concept. So that was kind of the sort of expansion of all the things that I'd learned in doing a physics undergraduate, and that kind of funneling me towards illustration, both in the representational drawing of a fossil way and also in the equation kind of way. Yeah, so after illustration, continuing from that, I got really interested in textures when I was doing illustration, and I was doing all these really detailed drawings of rocks and of bits of meat and of cheese and here's an illustration of cheese, but just being like, wow, this texture of goat's cheese is really fluffy close up. and this kind of ambiguity that textures have when you're really close up to them. And that sent me down the path of medical illustration. So that's what I did after that. Did like a foundation in medical illustration, which was another really interesting change in terms of art practice, because the more archetypal or simplified an image is, the more that image is useful to a surgeon or a doctor, because it's easier for them to interpret the differences, the individual differences in anatomy, and sort of understand each individual anatomy. There's lots of variation between individuals. So if they're doing surgery, they know, no, this is the main branching pattern and I can cut here. So that was really interesting. And I was working in a dissecting room for 3 years, and just trying to get on with my own practice and getting kind of confused and experimenting with textile printing and with Devore, which is kind of like it dissolves some of, it's like something you can do with like velvet, which has got cellulose, and then the warp is made of cellulose, and then a cellulose based fiber, and then the weft is made of something synthetic, and then the Devore material dissolves either the warp or the weft, I can't actually remember. Yeah. But you can make interesting windows in the velvet. And then did teacher training, because it was just completely impossible to make any money doing any of those things. And approached a lab called CABI, which is the Centre for Advanced Biomedical Imaging at UCL, about developing a project there, but I didn't really have any ideas about what I wanted to do, so I didn't get any funding for that, which is like, you know, fine. So I was doing like working with them alongside teaching, and figured out that I didn't actually want to work with images, because the creating of an image in biomedical imaging research is like the doing of the science. So it seemed like I had to not do anything representational, but look at a process. That was in 2014 when I started doing that. And then that eventually turned into my PhD, which I guess can be summarised as visualising physical phenomena through craft.
So the material that we are going to be talking about today is loosely called it fibres.
Yes.
I guess let's define first, like, what do we mean by fibres?
Okay, fibres are, I guess most people will think about carbohydrates or the fibres that you get in food, and you can get fibres in all kinds of materials that might grow out of the earth, like you'll have trees and plants that will have cellulose in them that we can take, so you can imagine like the cotton bowl, which is like got lots of cellulose in it, and you will take a fiber from that and then twist that into yarn and weave with it. I haven't actually mentioned weaving, but weaving is a thing that I'm doing, but we'll talk about that later. Maybe also fibers are kind of like they're like an overarching structure in the work that I do. So in the weaving work that I do, obviously the yarns are made out of fiber, and what I'll do is I tend to use yarns that have been given to me by people. There's a lot of people who don't weave anymore who used to weave a lot, and all of the weaving materials that I have and all of the weaving equipment that I have is all stuff that I've found online and that belongs to other people, and it's quite all used to belong to other people. They've given it to me. You can't just bring, I mean, sometimes people bring big balls of wool to charity shops, but you can't bring all of your yarn to charity shops because people just aren't going to take it in or aren't going to be able to shift it, but there's a lot of really interesting places where I can find that. Fibers are also in these other things that I make as part of the work that I'm doing, which are these objects called phantoms, which we can elaborate on later. But the phantoms will contain things like bits of wood, bits of plant matter, again, which have fibers in there, often made from cellulose, but also will have more protein-based fibrous materials, such as wool's a good one. Wool I also weave with from time to time, but it's really difficult to weave with because it's fluffy and it gets stuck to everything and it's horrible. I don't like it. I mean, not some people love it, but no, it's not for me. Cork, I'll put all these kind of different materials inside these objects called phantoms.
So you've brought some work here to show me. Can you describe kind of what the work is that you're doing at the moment and what these objects are?
Yeah, okay. So essentially, a lot of it is connected to what happens to materials when they're in an MRI scanner. And then a lot of it is also to do with how different materials can kind of simulate biological, anatomical materials inside a kind of, I guess, a mammalian body, except not exclusively mammalian. So what, these look nothing like bodies. There is one thing that looks a little bit like a hand. Actually, it does look like a hand. Actually, it is a cast of a hand filled with nonsense. But what they mainly look like are these kind of geometric polygons. The one that I have in my hand here is made of resin. A clear polyester resin, which is a horrible material to work with artistically. I have lots of problems with it, so I don't know if I'll be working with it again. So it's like a clear, not completely transparent, but like a frosty clear kind of weird looking, transparent-ish geometric polygon, and it has little bits of like sort of white powdery detritus on the outside. You can just about see inside it that it's got these weird little bubbles that contain some kind of liquid. Some of them have got things that look a little bit like a sponge or like fibers. Some of them have got this gloopy pink stuff. I'm going to reach over and pick it up. Gloopy pink stuff sort of on top of it that some people really like the look of, they want to eat them, and some people think look disgusting, which is interesting. Some of them have tubes and bubbles protruding out of them. Those are the geometric shaped ones, half of which are made of this horrible resin material and half of which are made out of different types of wax. So just whatever wax I could get hold of. But ideally, I wanted to use wax that didn't have a pigment to it, because different pigments used to make coloured wax have got metals in them and they come up funny on an MRI scanner. And they are very similar, although they look kind of more tidy and geometric than the other ones because they're opaque. So they're just these like opaque polygon shaped things. I've been told it's an Archimedean solid because it has different shapes. It's got triangles and squares, but I just feel like an idiot when I say it's an Archimedean solid. But I don't really wanna... Anyway, whatever. Some of them are cylindrical. I've got this one here, which is really interesting because I ran a workshop for people to make phantoms, and one of the people in the workshop made this one. So they cast their hand and then they gave it back to me and said, here you go, take it back, put it in an MRI scanner and send me the data. And cool. I was like, yes, great. And I will do some scanning in September so that we can see what the internal structure is like. But it's like it's a left hand sort of looking like it's sort of pinching something. It only goes up just before the wrist. And then there's like a big red plastic tube coming through it and fluffy bits of lichen and plant matter poking out from it and a tube poking out from it.
And some glassware, is that?
This is plastic.
Plastic.
This is one of those things used by people that do DIY beer making or brewing. It's called a bubbler stopper, and it allows the carbon dioxide to escape and no bacteria to get into your beer. A sponge. Sponges are really, really prominent in the things that I've been making. So sponge is made of cellulose too. And sponge, just the kind of sponge that you'll buy in an art shop. But again, it's a natural sponge. It's a living, was once lived. Well, I guess it's still living. You can still bring them back to life. So I feel morally compromised using.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It.
Cool.
Yeah. You can, like, can't you put them in a blender and then blitz them up with water and then take the blitzed up sponge liquid mix out and see the actual sponge reforming?
No way, that's
I've
cool.
never done this before, but I've been told that it works by several people.
Nice.
So maybe Anna from the future can do an experiment.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Anna from the future. Just wanted to pop in here and say that I've done some reading online and it appears that Jennifer is absolutely correct. Sponges, when broken down into even their individual cells, can reassemble themselves back into sponge material. Turns out that sponges are the only animals or plants that are able to do this.
Awesome. Okay, so what do these objects represent?
Okay, so can I? I'm just going to quickly talk about the MRI, like what happens in an MRI scanner, because I think it will help to explain what they are. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, a phantom is an object that's used in MRI research, but also in other biomedical imaging research, and is used to kind of test and calibrate a machine, an MRI scanner or a CT scanner or whatever. And in from what I understand it, and I'm not an expert, so if I'm wrong and loads of people complain, I'm very sorry. But what seems to what happens is that you kind of have to tune into different materials in the MRI scanner. So everything is made of atoms. Inside atoms, you have protons. They have things inside them, but I'm not talking about those. The protons are always spinning around in different directions all the time. So that's in living and in non-living matter, anything that contains, atoms, essentially. And in a really, really strong magnet, you can kind of line them up so that they're like all spinning in different directions and then all lining up almost like they're in a synchronized dance, or like they're synchronized swimmers. And then you have to add some energy to those protons. So what they use in an MRI scanner is radio frequency pulses. And a radio frequency pulse has less energy than sunlight. But it's enough energy to get these lined up protons to move out of their alignment slightly, and they'll move out of their alignment to slightly different degrees depending on what material they're in. So depending on if they're in blood or in, so water in the blood, or in fat, or in bone, or in brain stuff, or other organs, whatever they're in, they'll move out to different degrees. And then you refocus the magnet to re-line them up, and then they have to kind of vomit out that extra energy that they've taken in. And then you record that, you pick up on that energy that they've vomited out using these radio detection coils. It's almost like a radio receiver, and it's a slightly different frequency from each different type of atom, which is really interesting because it's almost like you can kind of almost communicate with these things that are completely and utterly like untouchable. Like you can't actually touch like an individual, like proton. It's just not possible. Although you can stroke water, and water's got hydrogen on it,
mm-hmm.
and so maybe that's touching them. I don't know. So that waveform, essentially, all those waveforms, they're really messy. They're all over the place, and you use a special kind of maths. Called a Fourier transform, which is really horrible to do, but you can get a computer to do it for you.
Woohoo!
And then, and out pops a picture, magically, of the cross-section of somebody's abdomen or their head or something. And it was that process that I kind of fell in love with. So on that basis of it being important that the hydrogen atoms are available, I chose a lot of different materials that were organic, essentially, or that were plastics with or proteins that have a high proton density or hydrogen density. So inside some of these phantoms, what I've got is these bubbler stoppers, which are used by brewers, and I've melted things like shea butter and cocoa butter and olive oil and acetone and alcohol, and put all these different liquids inside them and sealed them with a hot glue gun so that I'd get lots of different readings, because those things all have hydrogen in them. And anything that anything will be, it's kind of hard to tune into all materials, but it is possible to tune into any material if it's submerged in water, from what I understand.
Mm, okay.
Except you wouldn't put iron in an MRI scanner because it would break your machine.
Magnetic, right?
Yeah, or like ferromagnetic. I don't know. It's got a property in it, the magnets, that makes it go crazy.
Okay.
Yes, but you can put aluminium in an MRI scanner and chrome, and it will just levitate, and you can move it around using the MRI scanner.
That's
which is
cool.
Very fun. Yeah, I can't remember what I was talking about.
Awesome. Well, we were talking about the materials that we were using, and the fact that you specifically chose them because they would be suitable for using in an MRI scanner for the reason that you just explained.
Yes, and so, the point of this art project was kind of to visualise physical phenomena through craft. So this was my way of doing that, which is probably a really indirect way of doing it, but it was, for me, a way of kind of creating an analogue to a body that wasn't anything like a body. It's not a model. You couldn't use this in a scientific experiment or anything. And also, they end up having their own aesthetics, and because of all the different liquids in them, some of them are quite unstable, and some of them are starting to dissolve. So they're kind of almost like these like melting, living kind of things. I guess the other material that I'll need to talk about is the yarn, which is, you know, made of fibre. So what I've been working with is silk and with cotton. And these are from reels of materials that were given to me by different people. Silk is amazing to weave with because it's really smooth. But essentially, the way that the loom that I have works, the way it works is that it either does or doesn't lift a shaft. It's called a dobby loom, and it's a floor loom, and it's in my living room, and it takes up a lot of space. It's slightly annoying, but it's also amazing. And what I wanted to do using the loom was to try and figure out how the Fourier transform was turning a point at a waveform into a picture. So what was actually happening through that process? Because it seemed almost like it was magic that it worked at all. And I got really interested in that, really. Yeah, so weaving it. So weaving the what happens to like a data point in a scan, as well as having finished scans of the phantoms themselves, seemed to be an interesting way of trying to sort of interact with the different things that are going on inside this really weird environment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Is this something that you use on your loom, this object in front of you here?
Yes. So this object here is, these are lags. And a lag, so the lags are connected by chains, and they have got 16 holes along them. So it's like a kind of, they kind of look like Toblerones.
A little wooden Toblerone, but...
Yeah, really long.
If it was just like a solid, like without the individual pieces.
Yes, without the individual pieces, but they have that kind of, they look kind of like Toblerones, but they're...
Or Kit Kats, actually.
Or Kit Kats, yes, they're much more like Kit Kats.
Much more of a Kit Kat.
You're right. They're actually closer to their dimension. It's like two Kit Kats stuck to each other. Yeah. So you've got a really long Kit Kat.
A long, thin Kit Kat.
Yes, exactly.
It's got 16 little holes along the top.
16 little holes in them, and you put these tiny little wooden dowels inside the little holes, and you hammer them in place. And wherever there is a dowel, a shaft will not lift up. And whether that, hang on, I've got to get this right. Wherever there is a shaft, where there is a dowel, it will not lift. And wherever there is no dowel, it will lift. So it means you either do have warp visible or not warp visible. So you can sort of pictorially represent digital information. Essentially, it's just like memory storage or like Fortran. Which is a crap way that people used to do coding. I'm probably going to get... Yeah. Well, it wasn't crap. It probably just looked like it took forever and was really wasteful, but never mind.
And anyway, I think that's kind of based on, like, you know how...
It wasn't crap, sorry.
It's fine. You know how in, like the first computers was based on, like, little punch cards of cardboard?
Yes.
And there was, like, patterns of holes, and that was a way that they sort of gave the computer information in, like, a mechanical way. This seems like very analogous to that.
It is. And the Jacquard loom was mechanically and conceptually was the sort of thing that Babbage used to design his machine.
Oh, right, cool.
Or like inspired his machine. I don't know whether he like was like, I'm going to copy this, but there's a nice continuum with the history of programming and computers and the history of this type of weaving, these sort of big machines. People hated them when they first got made, though. They really did. They hated them a lot. And weavers traditionally wore clogs to protect their feet from things falling. And when they first released the Jacquard looms, they took off their clogs and they just threw them at the looms. And yeah, and that's where the word sabotage comes from, because sabot in French is a clog.
No way. It's
sabotage. Yes.
Which so they sabotaged their looms because they hated them.
Yeah, they hated them. And then
that's
they
cool.
just didn't really get a choice, because everyone was like, we want to make lots of money. We don't care about your lives. We don't care about the things that you make.
Classic.
Yeah, classic, classic move. Industrial Revolution move. So so people got, you know, had a hard time, and now these sort of textile technologies are like, oh, look at how old they are, and they're so exciting, and there's this like weird nostalgia, which is kind of really gross, but kind of interesting to see happen with this kind of resurgence of, you know, everybody wants to make their own bread and everyone wants to make their own things nowadays, and it's like a desperate kind of grabbing for authenticity in terms of modes of production, because everything's like mass produced, and we had a little chat earlier, and everything is destroying the planet and destroying people.
Yeah.
So
back to the loom.
Yes.
How does the weaving relate to the MRI scanning work?
So the way it relates to the MRI scanning work, as in, so from an ethical point of view, to do this work, and it was, you know, it's an interest in physics, it's an interest in materials, it's an interest in the materials that bodies are made of that kind of made this project kind of happen. But from an ethical point of view, I can't just use people's data. I can't just go, oh, give me this person's data, or give me your science data that has got these cells in it, or that has mice bodies in it.
Okay.
Like, it just didn't seem appropriate. So it was kind of quite serendipitous that I came up with originally it was just a weaving project, and it's kind of grown into this project that's about these phantoms as well, and about how things can be kind of made of these different materials and be similar to us in some kind of way. When I first learned, and also the fact that it's called a phantom, I think is really interesting. And that's what the scientists call them. And often, so something that might be used to be a phantom that is just simulating the brain could be anything as complicated as like a sort of plastic brain with tubes in it, or it could be just a perspex container full of water. It just depends.
Okay.
So they really range in, they really vary. There's a really big range and a big variety in what they are. And it's really, like, phantoms are really strange because they're made by people like Siemens and Philips and these like strange companies that make electronic devices, but they're also making this like very, very niche piece of equipment that gets sold to biomedical imaging people, and they're sold for a lot of money. So it's quite nice also to say, well, you could also make them out of these things, and so some of them have pineapple slices in them, and pineapple slices are great because they look a lot like muscle fiber.
Oh, cool.
In the MRI scanner.
Yeah.
So I could maybe at some point show you some pictures of what they look like when they're in the MRI scanner.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
So the scientists use them to kind of calibrate their machines, or to practice the scans, or how do they use them?
I think like that. So to sort of figure out, like, oh, I want to look at water, let's put this container of water in it and let's see if I can see it.
Right.
And so it's like you know, I think the first ever MRI scans were done with phantoms because they had to put something in there to test it on, and they didn't want to put anything alive in there because they were just like, I don't know, we've just made this thing, so who knows what it's going to do. So that's, and I really wish I had done some more research to figure out why they call it a phantom, but I guess it's, they're not, there's not really anything there that is what you want to scan. Maybe that's it. But it's nice because it kind of adds this kind of weird, ghosty kind of esoteric language into this sort of environment that normally sort of despises that kind of world.
Mm.
So it's really great to kind of throw it around and...
Yeah, like anti-science.
Yeah, like scan my sculptures, look at my phantoms. Yeah, it's good. It's good fun.
That's awesome. So what have you managed to... Like, what sort of data have you managed to collect?
So what I've managed to collect... So I'm working... It's important to say that I am working with somebody at the Francis Crick Institute to do these scans. His name is Bernard Xiao, and he's amazing at making invisible things visible through the scanner. So it isn't the case that we just put it in, first of all, and then we can instantly see all of the internal structure. He'll have to make the machine do certain things.
You're twiddling some knobs there. Is that kind of how it works?
Yes. So actually, Bernard let me tune the machine, which is great. He actually let me do it. I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing, but this is great. And then he was talking about biting point, and I was like, great, but I can't drive. But I understand. I think in principle, this is just such a thrill to just be able to kind of go into this environment and kind of be a bit daft and silly, and everyone's really serious and sort of target focused, and you're like, hey, look at this. It looks like a cube or a hand, put it in the scanner, and to kind of disrupt that kind of work without interfering serious sort of cancer curing science research. And I'm using the scanner when no one else is using it, just so that people know that I'm not ruining cures for cancer,
ruining science for everybody.
Yeah, for everyone. I think you also asked me a question and I don't think I actually answered it. I don't really know.
Well, one of the things I'm interested in is like, have you seen anything surprising come out of these scans that you didn't expect?
Yeah, well, I think it's just that the contrasts look very different, and you can add coloured filters. Also, like, I don't remember how I put these together. I mean, you can kind of see with the resin ones what it's like on the inside. You can't really see that with the wax ones. And I guess what it is for me, any from my point of view, and I think to an extent from to Bernard's point of view, and without Bernard I wouldn't be able to do this, and you know, being able to kind of connect with these different protons in these different materials and being able to kind of touch this scale of matter that is just so beyond anything that I'm familiar with, that's just really interesting. So I feel like the way that it actually looks in the MRI scan is as unsurprising as it look as a scan of like your own body might look. So you know that you've got organs, you know they have certain shapes, and I know that I've got inside some of these phantoms, I've got these bubbles that have these different materials in them. One thing that we did do was put a chrome ball bearing in one of the little bubble compartments and see if we could move it through to like move it into different compartments, almost like a little maze.
Cool.
And I think that some like people at CABI are trying to think about whether that could be a form of surgery in the future. So you could sort of, I think it was, yeah, it's people at CABI like thinking about Mark Lithgow, I think, had the idea of injecting it into a bloodstream and moving it. Yeah, it was Mark Lithgow. And putting it and moving it into different parts of the body. And I guess you could, you know, navigate it using the magnet into like a tumor and then internally destroy that tumor. And I guess in a way, while these are kind of silly, it's like, well, we could use this as like, you know, like as like a gym for the ball bearings and the magnet, the MRI magnet kind of interaction, and practice moving them through different materials and compartments and see if we can complete a maze or something. And it kind of helps them to figure things out that they can do with the machine as well. And so it's not very easy to do. And sometimes what's interesting is that because it can heat up, so it can melt some of the shea butter or the butter, it can go through the oil, but then when it gets to the the pineapple slices, it kind of gets stuck. But I really like the idea of going through the pineapple slices and finishing the maze.
Nice.
Yeah.
Could you make the ball bearing into like a little pointy knife so you can like cut through stuff and get through?
Yeah, I think actually there was I think Mark originally suggested like using like a spinning blade thing.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like almost like a what were those? Like a fidget spinner, but like a tiny fidget spinner.
Yeah.
With like points, cool. Not with like the round shape,
but with
I don't know what that's called. Pointy, three-pointed side spear.
Sure, let's call it that.
Yeah,
something pointy that would spin around.
Yeah,
and
something
cut
pointy
through
that
stuff.
Would spin around and cut through stuff. Absolutely,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. So I mean, that's something that is, I think, more surprising in terms of things that have come up, but. Yeah, it's not more surprising than seeing an MRI scan of a body. Mm. So yeah, it is interesting because there is a banality in all of this in that respect. So there is something like, oh, it looks like what we thought it looked like kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's different contrasts and we can move a little ball around. But we knew those things already.
Mm.
But also I'm not doing science. The experience of sort of interacting with people in this kind of environment as an artist, and it kind of maybe not being the type of art science work that is just about representation, but about exploring different environments and exploring sort of interactions between physical phenomena, but also between people. So like the politics of labs is really, really funny as well, really interesting. And I won't get too much into it, but it's just very interesting to just be sort of in this world and be like, wow, things that are really important to people that I would have never thought about. And I don't know, I think it's really kind of a bit scary sometimes when people are so focused on targets and aren't really questioning as much as they should be. I don't know, I guess I really feel sad about the use of mice in biomedical imaging research. And I feel sad like it's kind of a really, again, that's a banal way of talking about the ethics of using animals in science. But, you know, I guess that's why I want these around. I wonder whether they could be. I mean, they'll never replace a biological entity, but that's not what they're for, but there are lots of problems in biomedical research that I guess I'm trying to surround myself with. And whilst I can't really identify them all yet, and I don't really know how to think about them all yet, that's all part of the process. And the way that I discover that isn't by like asking lots of questions or isn't by being very interrogative, but it's kind of by observing and also by using the kind of tools that scientists use and by having conversations with them about their work. So I don't know.
So what's next?
So what's next is to finally get some of the data, the pictures that I've got. So when you have all the images that turn up on a screen, you can reverse Fourier transform them and see what it looks like in terms of the waveform. And I think this is something that's called K-space, which is really weird. It's a weird name. But what I need to do next is just actually get this onto these lags and these looms. And I think I'll probably need to get some software written or write some kind of software to help with that, because I don't even know how to begin thinking about it.
Mm.
Like visually representing K-space isn't a problem. Visually representing some anatomy isn't a problem necessarily, but representing a process on like a static strip so that the woven fabric actually becomes almost like a time-based medium, so that you can see as you look across the fabric a process that is unraveling or changing in time. That's going to be the next step. And currently the warp that I've got on the loom is all one color. And what I'm discovering is that actually I need to think really carefully about the warp that I'm using. There just needs to be contrast. It could be that some of the fibers that I'm using, not fibers, some of the yarns that I'm using are transparent. Some of them are made of plastic. Some of them are made of silk or wool or whatever. But there has to be a contrast in the warp. That's actually where all the action happens. And I did originally, when I first started weaving, which was literally when I started doing this, like, I don't know, like So I started properly weaving last year, and then maybe about 2 years before that, I started to begin learning it. But I didn't. It was very hard to get guidance from people with this with niche looms. And there's two people that I call on to help me. But it's interesting because it's the thing that I originally thought that it was the warp, the thing that changes, the thing that is easy to change, that would make the textile interesting and help to reveal the process more readily. But what I'm figuring out is that actually the thing that stays the same is the really important part. And tension, I didn't understand tension when I first started doing this. I thought that it just had to be really tight all the time. And then my warp threads kept snapping and I kept having to repair them and it took ages. And then actually what I was told actually by a weaver who knows how to use my loom called Juliet was that the tension just has to be consistent. And it doesn't have to be really, really tight. And it's when the warp threads snap, it's one of those things we always think about when people used to have to get, when people were paid by meter of yarn, of fabric that they wove, sorry, not yarn, of fabric that they wove, and that would happen when they were doing that, and that time and money and repair and that kind of like frustration, and your hands feel gigantic when I'm on the loom. Like they're so big, like even with the tiny little tools, like I can't actually use dissecting tools to do some of the weaving stuff because it's so tiny. And it can be quite abject at times, actually, fixing the warp. But yeah, I'm sort of learning a lot of stuff at this point in time that's going to take it into the next phase. So it's going to be mainly weaving from now on, I think. I'd like to make some more phantoms, but I think that would probably be me digressing or getting distracted because it's really fun to make.
Cool.
Yeah.
Have you got any images of these online, though, or where can people find out more about your work?
Yeah, so people can find my work on my website, jennifercrouch.com, also on Instagram, I think it's jennifer.crouch, and on Twitter as well. So I'll put things on there. And I always just want to re-put the same pictures on there, but then I just sort of think, oh, what's the point? I'll just like put a picture of a plant on. So yeah, it's funny. It's interesting trying to find ways of putting your work in an online space. I find it really really complicated, even though it should be really, just put it online. I'm just like, no, why is it so complicated to think about? Because I'm trying to think about how they're organized and how, I don't know.
Sort of curate a story of the images rather than just like random, like one-off images.
Yeah, maybe. Because it's you know, this project is such a mess in so many ways. There's so many different elements to it, and you know, writing about it in a really, or talking about it in a way that's really simple. I really struggle with trying to explain this because there's all these different processes, there's these different elements, there's different parts of science that I'm using. There's the weaving, there's the scanning. There's the phantom making, there's the exchanges in the lab. And I don't really know yet how to put all of that together, but I guess that's the whole point, really, of doing a PhD about it, I guess. So I don't know. But yeah, have a look. Maybe they'll make you hungry, maybe they'll make you sick. Find out.
So that was the wonderful Jennifer Crouch. Thanks so much to her for coming on the podcast and for showing me all of her weird and wonderful phantoms. I love how Jennifer's journey took her from physics to art and back again to physics. One of the things I'm trying to do on this podcast is really sort of dismantle that sort of made up binary that we've created, the art-science divide, and show that at least through materials, art and science are actually not as dissimilar as we think. So make sure you follow Jed on social media. It would be wonderful if you are enjoying the podcast that you were to rate and review it. I'd love to hear from you on Twitter. We're at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk. Or you can get in touch and say hi at realtalkpodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to say a quick thank you to Dave Shepherd for our marvellous cover art, to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. And next time, I'll be talking to artist, and good friend of mine, Holly Graham, about sugar. So until then, thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you next time on Handmade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.